Our speaker today is Shilpa Jindia. Shilpa is an attorney and journalist whose work probes the fault lines where law, power, and civil liberties intersect. Her writing is grounded in both legal analysis and historical perspective. Let me walk you through some of her recent works. In a 2023 Slate essay on the Supreme Court's Rahimi decision, she connects medieval laws around surety and going armed to contemporary efforts to reduce gun violence, especially in domestic abuse situations. Also in Slate, she tackled the debates over the Boycott, Divest, Sanctions, or BDS, movement, showing how student activism around Israel-Palestine has sparked a backlash threatening academic freedom, campus speech, and the principle of political expression at universities. In March 2025's Guilt by Association for the Baffler, she profiles Mahmoud Khalil, a green card holder targeted for deportation amid his pro-Palestinian activism. She charts how protest speech is being recast as terrorism through lawsuits and lawfare. Finally, in her 2019 Intercept feature on the USS Cole and Guantanamo military commissions, Shilpa describes how the US has wielded military tribunals and indefinite detention in the name of national security. She writes about the moral and legal compromises made at Guantanamo, particularly enduring tensions between justice, accountability, and executive power. Her work asks, how does the law protect and when does it oppress? When does safety become overreach? And how can legal systems be salvaged to uphold rights rather than suppress dissent? Please welcome me as we welcome Shilpa Jindia.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you. Good morning. Thank you so much for that generous introduction and for the invitation to join you this summer at the Lyceum. I'm honored to take part in this wonderful and historic tradition. I've been invited to speak on a rather urgent topic this morning, the fight for academic freedom. With this subject front and center in the news lately, I'm sure you all bring your own thoughts and concerns, which I look forward to hearing. You also got an excellent primer on this last summer from Summer Lopez with her talk on educational gag orders and book banning. Unfortunately, the situation has gotten much worse since then. Under Trump's second administration, we have seen an unprecedented assault on higher education, including cuts to federal funding and investigations launched into dozens of universities. It's true that Trump's second term is shaking our country's democracy to its foundations, but democracy has always been a fragile conceit. As I prepared this speech, I kept thinking of Ben Franklin's response to citizens asking what kind of government the delegates to the Constitutional Convention had chosen. A republic, he replied, if you can keep it. His comment meant that democracy requires an informed citizenry to maintain it. Over the last few decades, however, that quality of our social fabric has eroded. Our channels of information have been gradually hijacked from the collapse of the news industry to the pernicious influence of social media. The real root of this, however, is the right-wing war on higher education. Since the 1970s, universities have been a consistent target for the right. Why? Because they are sites of resistance and progress, and the concept of academic freedom is fundamental to this. It ensures that universities can pursue ideas and inquiry free from interference, and this freedom is a threat to any regime that craves power and control. Trump is the face of a broader right-wing agenda to reverse engineer the progress made in this country, namely racial equality. The administration is trying to fight an inevitable future in which America becomes a majority-minority country. Universities are microcosms of our society, and as such, are prime targets. It is also worth pointing out that America is not alone. Attacks on universities are part of a global playbook of authoritarianism in countries like Turkey, India, Australia, and especially Hungary. Students and universities have always been a front line in the fight against fascism because of their role in questioning power. Paradoxically, I hope that provides some kind of comfort. We are not alone, and this is not new. In fact, it's critical to understand how we got here, which is how I'd like to use my time today. I want to first establish what academic freedom means and how it helped usher in the golden age of higher education. From there, I want to look at the right-wing backlash to academic freedom and how it has been driven through moral panics and fear-mongering. Today, that is especially true as the Trump administration has cravenly weaponized anti-Semitism to go after universities. I reported on this for the Bathroom magazine last year. I wanted to look at the issue of the Gaza campus protests acutely and outside of the media fixation on Columbia University. I focused instead on the fallout at public universities, which are more vulnerable to political retaliation. I looked at my alma maters of Indiana University, where I got my undergraduate degree, and the City University of New York, or CUNY, where I recently got my law degree. While the protests raised issues that are deeply and personally felt, the real issue at hand is not the content of the protests, but the reaction to them. In many cases, the focus on allegations of anti-Semitism, while a serious and legitimate concern, have been weaponized to justify attacks on academic freedom. It was a moment where Democrats failed to stand up for these values, and Republicans used the opportunity to advance their agenda. While the content of this speech was uncomfortable or offensive to some, the response should not be to shut it down. Universities must remain free to challenge orthodoxy in power. Now, while universities have always been centers of knowledge, they were historically more obedient. The first universities in America were founded under the shadow of Christian theology and centered on tradition. As one historian put it, a college education, quote, supplied furniture and discipline for the mind, but constrained intellectual adventure, end quote. As the Enlightenment revolutionized ideas of the individual and society, philosophers began to rethink the purpose of the university. The Prussian philosopher William von Humboldt began to imagine the university beyond simple vocational training, to give people access to knowledge to craft their mind and character. The term academic freedom itself derives from his twin concepts of the freedom to teach and the freedom to learn. As political philosopher Judith Butler has noted, academic freedom is both a right and an obligation. It is the obligation to ask hard questions, to challenge the status quo, and to explore ideas that may be uncomfortable, controversial, or unpopular. It is the right to pursue knowledge, debate, and inquiry without fear or reprisal of censorship. This concept began to take root in Western and Eastern Europe in the 1920s and Latin America in the 30s and 40s. The American Association of University Professors first enshrined the concept in 1915 and has since become its steward. Academic freedom has become integral to the idea of higher education as institutions that produce knowledge for the common good. To fulfill this compact, scholars must be able to pursue truth without interference. There are two points worth stressing here. First, academic freedom should not be conflated with freedom of speech. One is a collective right, the other is individual. Academic freedom refers to the collective freedom of both scholars and the university itself from political intervention and censure by state or religious authorities. And second, academic freedom does not require neutrality. As institutions that are inspired by the idea of the common or public good, politics are unavoidable. One key document in the lineage of academic freedom is the Calvin Report, which was issued by the University of Chicago in 1967. It is often cited to support the view that universities should remain neutral on political and social issues. Yet even the report admits that, quote, a university faithful to its mission will provide enduring challenges to social values, policies, practices, and institutions. By design and by effect, it is the institution which creates discontent with the existing social arrangements and proposes new ones. In brief, a good university, like Socrates, will be upsetting, end quote. The AAUP has weighed in on this tension. While universities have no obligation to speak out on the most controversial issues of the day, they must speak up against political interference and to protect academic freedom. The AAUP knows this lesson well. Academic freedom was tested during the McCarthy period, a test that the AAUP failed at times through its own capitulation. The fear that pervaded overruled any sense of solidarity or injustice. McCarthyism sought to break alliances and isolate individuals, and it succeeded. Scholars lost their jobs, and those that didn't self-censored. Academics stopped using the word capitalism in their lectures, for instance, substituting it instead with industrialism. It was only the exigencies of the civil rights movement and the movement against the Vietnam War that revived universities with their sense of purpose. By 1967, the Supreme Court affirmed academic freedom as a core value of the First Amendment and of democratic society. It determined that the university must remain free of constraint or orthodoxy to allow ideas to flourish. Justice Brennan warned that, quote, scholarship cannot flourish in an atmosphere of suspicion or distrust, end quote. Yet questions of limitations on academic freedom, if any, still drive much of the debate today. Some, like Erwin Chemerinsky, the dean of UC Berkeley Law and a First Amendment scholar, advocate for the marketplace of ideas approach. Others try to distinguish between the pursuit of truth versus the unfettered exchange of ideas. It is not an easy question. While I recognize that the marketplace of ideas is not the level playing field that it purports to be, I myself am still figuring out how to draw the line. The slippery slope argument is often used in law, but when it comes to censorship, I think it's more true than not. It's easy to get mired in the weeds of this debate. It's best, then, to remember the words of bell hooks, who reminds us that education is ultimately a space of possibility and imagination to, quote, move beyond boundaries, to transgress. This is education as the practice of freedom, end quote. Academic freedom helped usher in what is referred to as the golden age of higher education. Through the GI Bill in 1944, university attendance boomed. Access to education became a ladder to the middle class and the American dream. Universities themselves became an experiment in democracy, a reflection of the melting pot that this country once boasted of. As long as the university has existed in this modern iteration, as a space for academic freedom, as a core pillar of democracy, as an essential pathway to maturation, protest and dissent has existed on campus. It is a feature, not a bug. At CUNY, for example, Eastern European Jewish refugees who settled in New York in the 1930s flocked to the school because of its free tuition and the discrimination faced at Ivy League universities. They led student protests, turning CUNY into a hotbed of anti-fascism. During the 1960s, CUNY students protested about political issues, but also pushed for changes within the university as well. They fought to keep tuition free and to decolonize the curriculum. Their efforts resulted in the creation of Black and Puerto Rican studies. And of course, they were not alone. Students were agitating for change across the country, making their voices known. Student movements were a key driver in the social movements of the 50s and 60s, and the progress made during that period would not have been possible without them. One alumna looked back at the protests and said, "We knew that as students, we could not stop the Vietnam War, nor could we end racism. But we could do our part, which at Columbia in 1968 was to broadcast as loudly as we could that students were willing to put their lives and futures at risk to end this awful war." Yet this activism also put a target on their backs. Students were denounced at the time as radicals overtaking an American institution. Their demands for equality, diversity, and for the end of the American war machine abroad was seen as an unpatriotic challenge to capitalism and American society. And thus began the right-wing campaign to dismantle the university. Ronald Reagan ascended to the governor's mansion in California off the back of public hostility towards the free speech movement at UC Berkeley. There, he began cutting state funding for higher education, imposing the tuition-based model that we know today, and he called in the National Guard, who brutally crushed the protests. He declared that taxpayers' money should not be, quote, subsidizing intellectual curiosity, end quote, and instead returned to vocational training. One commentator noted that the day he announced the firing of the president of the UC system, the purpose of college changed. Free tuition ended, including at CUNY, and the price of a college education steadily ballooned. Education went from a post-war right to a personal privilege. Neoliberal policies have since turned universities into ruthless businesses, where students are clients and faculty are disposable. Tenure, an essential element of academic freedom, is increasingly rare. Today, more than 70% of college and university teaching is done by non-tenured faculty. And to be fair, both Republicans and Democrats have had a hand in reducing the value of a college education to mere dollars and cents. What is the point of an intellectual adventure if all you get in return is a lifetime of debt? That ladder to the middle class no longer reaches high enough in an age of staggering inequality. And the humanities, the backbone of critical thinking, has been steadily derided as a space for political correctness and now wokeness. In reality, college campuses have always been a battleground for the nation's culture wars. They are microcosms of the fight for progress. The obsession with wokeness is only the latest iteration and a reflection of the tensions of our supposedly post-racial era. As activists from the Black Lives Matter movement and the left have succeeded in pushing our attention to the issues of police violence and anti-racism, the right has responded in kind. Enter critical race theory, the right's latest boogeyman. This term became ubiquitous as the right has whipped up outrage over supposed left-wing infiltration of education from kindergarten to college. Young children are supposedly forced to feel guilty for being white. High schoolers are being indoctrinated with Marxist theories. But this panic was completely manufactured. A man named Christopher Rufo seized on a niche subject within legal studies and found that it was the perfect vehicle to attack the left. According to him, the term political correctness was too dated. Cancel culture was too vacuous. Woke was a good epithet, but too broad, too easily brushed aside. Critical race theory instead represented something, quote, hostile, academic, divisive, race-obsessed, elitist, and anti-American, end quote. The same old pejorative message dressed up in new clothes. Now, let me say, having returned to university for my law degree in my mid-30s, I myself experienced a stark change in the tenor of campus discourse. I grew frustrated with younger students who I saw as incredibly impassioned, yet self-righteous. Conversations were shut down when they felt harmed. I felt a generational difference, too. I was politicized by September 11th and the run-up to the Iraq War. These students had grown up in the age of Trump and identity politics. Perhaps, though, the major difference was social media, which has largely served to flatten discourse to its most extreme ends. But the answer is not to censor speech or control universities. Rather, it is incumbent on academic institutions to find new ground rules for these difficult discussions. Yet this is exactly what right-wing legislatures have done. Their plan was to take over college curricula and eliminate tenure protection for faculty, what was left of it anyway. A blueprint of this can be found in the right-wing takeover of the progressive New College of Florida, which Summer Lopez also mentioned last year. In early 2023, Governor Ron DeSantis installed six new members to the 13-member Board of Trustees, including Christopher Rufo. The new board then eliminated New College's diversity offices and pushed out adjacent personnel. The administration later shut down the student-led Gender and Diversity Center and threw out hundreds of books from its donated library in the dumpster. It became clear that the outrage over woke education was simply a smokescreen to attack the ideas that most threaten them. The Florida legislature also passed a key piece of legislation that created a post-tenure review of faculty at public universities, in effect, ending the concept of tenure altogether. As other conservative legislatures geared up to introduce similar measures, Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. While the widespread student protests attracted national attention, the crackdown that followed affected far more than student encampments, especially outside of the Ivy League limelight. A month after the attack, Professor Abdelkader Sino filled out a form to reserve a room for a public event on behalf of a Palestinian student group that he advised. They wanted to organize a talk with Miko Peled, an Israeli-American peace activist. Sino was a tenured professor in the political science department at Indiana University. I had taken his class on Middle East politics some 20 years prior when I was an undergraduate student. So I was shocked when I saw headlines that this box-checking exercise resulted in his suspension. Numerous faculty decried the decision, not only as a violation of university policy, but also of the shared governance among faculty that is so important to academic freedom. Professor Sino told me that he viewed the suspension as retaliation. University President Pamela Witten had released two statements following the attack. One was too tepid, failing to recognize the affected on either side. After widespread criticism, the second statement issued recognized only the pain of the Jewish community on campus. At that point, Israel's war in Gaza had already killed more than 1,500 Palestinians. Professor Sino wrote to her twice, urging her to make a statement that recognized, quote, the empathy of everybody, not just one side of the conflict, end quote. After suspending him, the administration then canceled a career retrospective of a Palestinian-American alumna. Then, in April 2023, when police began raiding student encampments, IU made national and international headlines when photos emerged of snipers perched on rooftops. Just like those photos from Kent State, it's an image no one will forget. Then Republican State Representative Jim Banks published an op-ed defending Witten's handling of the protests, warning out-of-touch ideologues that IU belongs to Indiana. He urged his state to follow the lead of Florida, which had successfully taken on, quote, politically hostile activist public universities, end quote. Here was an invitation to use the protests as justification to launch a state takeover. As it was, the state legislature had just passed a bill similar to Florida's, instituting post-tenure review and requiring ideological diversity, which is code for more conservative thinking. The charged atmosphere following October 7th also turned blue states against the faculty and students of the public institutions under their care. The CUNY administration, backed by Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, launched an investigation into alleged anti-Semitism within its institutions, even though it had commissioned a similar one less than a decade earlier. Following student protests over the 2014 war in Gaza, CUNY commissioned a similar investigation into anti-Semitism. The final report concluded that while the students' words and banners may have offended some, it was protected speech under the First Amendment, and the university could not take action against them. Universities have long served as hubs for activism and organizing over the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One of the most prominent Jewish organizations today, Jewish Voices for Peace, was founded in 1996 by three undergraduate students at UC Berkeley. The first chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine was also established there in the 1990s. The conversations about Israel and Palestine have always taken place in concert with larger discussions about the United States' role in the world as an imperial superpower. And this itself is a legacy of past efforts to decolonize the university, to evolve its curriculum beyond the Western gaze. And the protests themselves explicitly called back to student movements of the past. Students were demanding a ceasefire, but their campaigns were also more pointed, calling for divestment from Israeli companies profiting from occupation and war. This is certainly not the first divestment campaign at a university. At Columbia, for example, students occupied buildings not only in 1968 over the Vietnam War, but again in 1985 for 3 weeks. They renamed Hamilton Hall as Mandela Hall, to demand that the school divest from corporations profiting from apartheid in South Africa. Columbia became the first university to divest, and others soon followed. Columbia has also since committed to divesting from tobacco, thermal coal, Sudan, fossil fuels, and private prisons, though not all of these ties have been broken. As universities have increasingly turned to powerful business interests for funding, questioning these ties is not only morally permissible, but necessary to ensure academic freedom. For example, many campaigns are underway at other schools to push for divestment from fossil fuels. These movements are not just about breaking the hold of powerful oil and gas companies, but also rooting out money that influences critical research taking place within universities. So if these protests fall within a clear lineage, why have they generated so much controversy? The fact is that American policy towards Israel has long been a third rail in this country, one I experienced myself. As I mentioned, my political consciousness was shaped by our response to 9/11, to the manufacture of consent for an illegal war, and the subversion of the rule of law by creating an extrajudicial gulag, one, I should mention, that is still open. I moved to Syria in 2009 to study Arabic and to witness the impacts of our foreign policy for myself. By extension, I also became more interested in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I would send dispatches home to a wide range of friends. When I forwarded a newsletter about housing demolitions in East Jerusalem, I was baffled to be told in response that I was, quote, drinking the Kool-Aid, end quote. It has long been taboo to address the United States' relationship with Israel, despite the clear consensus among international human rights bodies regarding the occupation of Palestinian territory. The International Court of Justice issued a landmark opinion in 2006, almost 20 years ago now, that Israel's separation wall violated international law. In the interim, Israel has entrenched its settlements in the West Bank to the point that last year, the same court ruled that Israel's prolonged occupation amounted to de facto annexation. The student protests have broken the long silence around this subject, not to endanger our Jewish communities, but to call attention to this country's financial and military support that is inextricable from Israel's ability to exist today as a state that sees repression and occupation as necessary for its survival. As during the Vietnam War, students are sickened by our complicity in atrocities. Just as we produced the napalm that we dropped on the Vietnamese, our tax dollars fund the bombs that fall on Gaza. Allegations of anti-Semitism have been consistently deployed to silence speech on this topic and to delegitimize the speaker. After October 7th, it was no longer just accusations of anti-Semitism, but smears of pro-Hamas speech. And to be clear, there were incendiary incidents. One Columbia student was suspended and banned from campus for comments made on social media about killing Zionists. Incidents like these, though, were the exception and not the norm. The protests were overwhelmingly peaceful and attended by students of all faiths and backgrounds. Our values of academic freedom and free speech would still protect uncomfortable comments like this unless it was found to incite imminent lawless action. Yet the fear that surrounds this entire subject has left it open to weaponization. Pro-Israel groups have been pushing the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism, which conflates comments about the state of Israel and Zionism with anti-Semitism. Even the IHRA's original drafter has come out against this interpretation. He clarified that it was never meant to be a campus hate speech code, and that Trump's adoption of it during his first term was about suppressing political speech. That this debate between anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism cannot be resolved underlines that without an accepted definition in the academic community, silencing speech on these grounds invites more danger than safety. We have now seen exactly what this means. After the campus encampments were disbanded in militarized police raids last spring, student activism largely died down. Students have continued pursuing divestment, though, outside of the media spotlight. That is, until Trump. Since Trump has come to power again, he has used the mantle of anti-Semitism to launch an all-out assault on higher education. The level of political interference and harm already exceeds what we saw in the McCarthy era. Several international students were abducted by ICE for their pro-Palestinian speech. Rumeysa Ozturk was snatched off the street in broad daylight, while Mahmoud Khalil was taken away from his pregnant wife and missed the birth of his first child. Badr Khan Suri was taken as retaliation for his wife's speech because she's a US citizen. These individuals were then flown thousands of miles away, or hundreds of miles away rather, from their loved ones to detention centers in Louisiana and Texas. Not only is this its own form of cruelty, the Trump administration was attempting to keep any legal challenges in the ultra-conservative Fifth Circuit. We've heard about the inhuman conditions in these facilities, whether having their whole bodies chained or sharing a dorm with 70 other people where the harsh lights stay on 24 hours a day. In many of these cases, these challenges have largely failed. The government could not produce a shred of evidence that these students posed any kind of risk. It is clear, instead, that these malicious prosecutions were punishment of protected political speech. The government couldn't even tie these students to any anti-Semitic comments, only speech that either advocated for Palestinian rights or criticized Israel's actions in Gaza. Trump is doing the same thing with student activists as he is with the mass detention and deportation of other non-citizens. He is exploiting social tensions to erode our rights. He is taking advantage of the timidity and ambivalence of higher education institutions to trample on academic freedom. These students are human beings, and Trump hopes that the dehumanizing rhetoric surrounding their identity will somehow justify these gross violations. The Trump administration is also using anti-Semitism to launch investigations into dozens of universities and force them under its thumb. It sent a letter to Harvard in April demanding large-scale changes, including reducing the power of tenured and untenured faculty, as well as students, and auditing programs and departments that, quote, most feel anti-Semitic harassment or reflect ideological capture, end quote. Programs in their sites include the Carr Center for Human Rights, the Center for Middle Eastern Studies, the Divinity School, and the School of Public Health. Though Harvard has resisted, it also dismissed the leaders of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies. The university also adopted the IHRA definition in January, pursuant to a lawsuit settlement. But the administration isn't backing down. It is now threatening the university's ability to enroll foreign students, and just this past week announced that it will be sending administrative subpoenas for information about its foreign students. On the other hand, Columbia has shown us that capitulation doesn't look much different. After the administration pulled more than $400 million in federal funding on the grounds of anti-Semitism, the university caved to their demands. As part of the agreement, Columbia agreed to put its Middle Eastern, South Asian, and African Studies departments under outside control. A former chair of the Middle Eastern Studies Department called it, quote, the end of the American university as we've known it since 1915, end quote, when the AAUP first issued its guidelines on academic freedom. The situation today is very dire. We are entering a new McCarthy era, one that I think McCarthy himself couldn't even fathom. I hope the history and context I've shared today has been helpful in showing how the right has used culture wars to steadily erode academic freedom. Their true desire is to create a pliant citizenry and to take us into the past. And when we cede ground because of our own discomfort, we give them even more ammunition. But again, we are not alone, and this won't last forever. When the Trump era ends, it will be up to us to reaffirm the role of higher education as a caretaker for the public good. When that happens, I hope you'll remember bell hooks' formulation of education as a space for possibility and imagination, as a practice of freedom. This is the space you have created here with the Lyceum. I hope the conversations here continue to offer you community and strength, and I thank you again for welcoming me into it. Thank you.
Thank you, Shilpa, for your thoughts on academic freedom and college campuses. We will have some time for questions from the audience. For those watching virtually, you may continue to submit your questions using the live chat section on YouTube. And while the ushers collect the cards, let me begin by asking this. So if institutions like Harvard, CUNY, Columbia, University of Indiana, large, prominent universities, if they're targets, what are the prospects for smaller colleges and universities that aren't necessarily in the headlines, or is the entire point to make headlines?
That's a good question. The prospect for smaller colleges and universities are even worse than the prominent universities that are in the headlines. We've already seen under the Trump administration's executive orders on DEI and affirmative action that centers for gender and diversity have been closed in numerous states. Academic programs have been shut down, whether due to legislation forbidding classes on political or social activism, or just through budget cuts. And without making headlines, it's difficult to bring attention to this. And so those schools are going to suffer more than the ones that are sort of at the center of conversation. And public pushback, public opposition does have a role to play. I think the Trump administration is still aware that it has to respond to public protest, which is why it's so important. But for those schools that are outside of the limelight, I'm very concerned for what will happen to its students and faculty.
Okay, thank you. I have some questions from the audience. So this one, my stepson is the newly appointed VP for DEI, yes, at Brown. He has already lost about 10 pounds. Any suggestions for calming his nerves as he considers what he can still achieve?
Oh, gosh. I wonder how long ago he took that position. That's not an enviable job to have right now. But it's critical that he stands up for those principles. Again, fighting for those values of academic freedom is more important than ever. And I think the most important thing is to lean on the community that academic freedom imbues. Hopefully other scholars, other people in the administration can share their fear together, and from that, gain the courage necessary to keep resisting. Resisting is frightening, and again, I think there are a lot of examples in history of student movements, of scholars who have fought back against fascist and authoritarian regimes, sometimes at the cost of their lives, but that resistance is all that we have. And so I think he should, on his own, use breathing techniques and try to calm himself down, but also gain strength from this fight, because it's critical and important, and it's down to people like him to use the opportunity of his position to fight back and to show that kind of leadership.
Speaking of resistance, another question from the audience. Thanks for the recent history lesson, but what are we to do now?
Keep resisting. No, it's sort of a the term is being used so much that it kind of loses its meaning. But I think coming to spaces like this, being in community, talking about these issues, is what we have to do. It's easy to be scared. It's easy to bury your head in the sand. But staying wise to what is happening and speaking up when the issue is in your backyard, when it comes up in some way, I think that's how you fight back. And again, it's easy to become a sort of passive consumer of news and information, which is thoroughly depressing and in some ways is kind of not meant, but you know, ends up making you feel helpless. And so that's why I think coming in person, having conversations, engaging your mind, and making connections with other people is one way to stave off that kind of darkness. In terms of more concrete actions, I think it becomes about pushing your local legislators to pass legislation that protects universities or, you know, with the other issues that you see going on, you know, passes undocumented immigrants that fights for these values. And then there, you know, everybody's kind of looking ahead to the 2026 midterms as a referendum on Trump. And there are concerns that Trump is going to try something to prevent elections from happening, whether in 2026 or 2028. He's already signaled some threat to the funding of elections, which is why public funding of elections is so important. And there are bills being passed about that in different state legislatures. I think Arizona is the first one that's been really working on this. And that's also a really important way to ensure that elections remain free and fair. So I think, again, having discussions here and then seeing what kind of concrete steps, concrete actions can be taken within the state to protect values is really important.
For parents of high school students, how can we find out what our various college policies on academic freedom?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know exactly. Colleges should have some kind of statement about it on their website, but I think the best resource would be the American Association of University Professors. As I said, they've been sort of the steward and champion for academic freedom. They issued that first guidelines and practice rules in 1915 and reaffirmed it in 1940, and they're very active in putting out statements, podcasts. They submit a lot of amicus briefs in lawsuits to keep reaffirming the value of academic freedom. So I think they would probably be the best resource to look at how universities are shifting their policies on academic freedom in light of what's happening with the Trump administration.
The administration has sought to draw a line between free speech versus ideology and woke propaganda. Is this a real distinction?
Distinction between free speech and
between ideology. Free speech and woke propaganda.
Is this a real distinction?
Yes.
Mine's a little bit jumbled thinking about that. I mean, people have their right to say what they want about education today, but I think it's more important to understand where this speech is coming from. Again, as I said, the entire woke propaganda thing is identifiable as misinformation down to a single individual, Christopher Rufo. He has not been shy or quiet about claiming victory over what's happening in colleges today because of the propaganda that he's put out around about wokeness. And this goes back at least sort of 40, 50 years. The right created institutions, whether think tanks or other societies, to try to fund and go after kind of all the values and institutions of society. The kind of big other example is the Federalist Society, where Leonard Leo, since the 80s, has been sort of recruiting and collecting the most conservative jurists to then be nominated to the judiciary and to the Supreme Court. And the left has been very far behind on this. We have civil society in terms of nonprofits, but it's not as controlled as the right wing has been with their institutions. And so, yes, everybody has free speech, but I think it kind of goes back to that issue of this notion of the marketplace of ideas. It's not this free and open exchange of ideas. There are power dynamics as to who gets to speak, who has the money to speak, and how different speech is received. And again, the Republicans, the right, have put a lot of money into controlling speech, most notably through Citizens United. And they're still working on expanding notions of corporate free speech while restricting individuals' free speech at the same time.
Please comment on the parallel effect, or parallel efforts, excuse me, to control and sanitize elementary, middle, and high school curriculum to eliminate anything that negatively reflects on the country. For example, can we be headed toward the denial of teaching about slavery?
I think we've already been there with comments about slavery as a job opportunity, or that it taught enslaved people, you know, helpful skills that they could use once they were free. It's incredibly frightening, and it, again, I think it goes back to this core mission of the right to roll back progress. It's this fight between the first founding of this country and the second founding after the Civil War with the Reconstruction Amendments that created the legislative, the constitutional scaffolding and framework for equality of all citizens. That's why they've gone after birthright citizenship. That's why they are going after immigrants. They are trying to roll back the entire idea of this country to its founding, in which only white men had power and the rest of us just suffered. Yeah, I mean, I think that is where we are headed, and that's why things like woke propaganda are distractions. There are smoke screens for what the Republicans are trying to do, and it's really important to keep your eye on the ball as to what the ultimate end goal is.
I'm very concerned about what is happening about academic freedom on college campuses. I also remember ultra-right speakers getting canceled because of protests. Do liberals share some responsibility for suppression of academic freedom as well?
Yeah, I think it's been a difficult topic for universities to navigate, and they never really found a good answer, and it's partly why we're here. But it again goes back to this idea that while all speech is pretty much free in this country, with some narrow exceptions, it's not equal. I think when you come to a college campus with speech about you know, that's anti-queer, that's anti-trans, that's not the same as speech that fights for the equality, that represents the equality of all. And it's been an issue, I think, here of seeing both sides as simply equal, when instead there needs to be a stronger response about speech that stands up for the rights of all over simply the right of another speaker to say whatever he wants that is about furthering ideas of oppression and injustice.
Do you have faith in the Justice Department to fight the good fight?
This current Justice Department? No. Absolutely not. Faith in the Justice Department and faith in the law. So I think that those are two separate points. I have been more heartened by the backbone of the judiciary that we've seen under Trump. Even though in Trump's first term, he did his utmost to stack the judiciary across district and appellate courts, most of his legal challenges have failed. And I think it's because judges, even if they're on the more conservative end of things, are typically risk-averse people. And I think there is a fealty to the rule of law that does override any kind of conservative ideology that they may believe in. And the exceptions to this are sitting in the Fifth Circuit. But in general, I think the judiciary itself has stood up to Trump, which is why in the latest spending bill, there was a measure in there that would, I'm forgetting the exact specifics, but it's trying to limit the power of trial courts. And you saw that with the recent Supreme Court decision about nationwide injunctions, they are also trying to limit the role of trial courts and standing up to Trump. So I think there are reasons to still be optimistic in that regard, and it is an essential element for any kind of true authoritarian takeover to take control of the judiciary. So in terms of its composition right now, that still does give me some hope. But we can't put all of our faith in the law. And I think the Justice Department under Biden was incredibly disappointing in its timidity to go after Trump. It basically slow-walked the investigation and prosecution of the January 6th insurrection of Trump himself. They did a great job of going after kind of individual protesters, and there were a lot of criminal convictions, probably up to like 1,300 or something, who were all then pardoned by Trump. But that inability to hold Trump accountable because of the fear of political division, which would have been unavoidable, and it was not, again, an enviable position to be in for Merrick Garland, it was still critical to do, to have some kind of accountability for that. I think a good analog is Brazil, where Bolsonaro also launched a military coup and tried to take over the presidency. And he was, there was a prosecution and conviction for that. And so even though he uses the same kind of propaganda about fake news and woke institutions or liberal institutions, all this kind of thing, it still matters that there was a prosecution on the books. And I think the lack of accountability here is going to be probably the greatest failure of the Biden administration, along with its failure to stand up to Israel.
Yeah, I've been told we have time for a couple more questions. You have compared this to McCarthyism, but do you see real parallels to China's purge of academia in the Cultural Revolution? Is that where we're headed?
I hope not. I don't know too much about it, so I can't answer the question as fully as I'd like. I hope it doesn't get to that degree, and I think one other thing about kind of Maoist purges is that often it was the left turning on themselves as well, or sort of purging their own party. And so I think it's incumbent on the left here to find better ways to resolve their differences with each other and to find more community and solidarity. The left has a tendency of kind of eating its own, the snake eating its own tail, and I think it needs to put those kinds of smaller divisions aside and form sort of broader solidarity against the administration. But I very much hope it's not going to go to that extent. I don't think it will, but we're in very unprecedented times. Okay. Don't hold me to anything I just said.
When I got this one, I saved it to put it aside for last, although I have no idea what the person asking the question is getting at about the fine folks here today. What can a bunch of old people in Peterborough do to bring back academic freedom?
Honestly, I'm really looking forward to the reception after this, where I want to hear your thoughts and experiences of academic freedom, your role in student protests and student activism. I think intergenerational conversations are critical. This country suffers from a self-imposed amnesia, and part of combating that is about having, again, more intergenerational conversations. I would have loved to have more of a sort of back and forth with you in this presentation about your experiences on college campuses and in student movements, but the format is what it is. But I think it's really about sharing your experience and informing younger generations and breaking us out of those silos, and would very much welcome your thoughts in that regard.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. This is a real honor. Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed today's presentation of the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. Thank you for your support of the 2025 season, and please come back next week to hear Dr. Annie Brewster talking about Stories for Health.